Hello, I'm John Rossi, a touring drummer with a love of all things animal. When I'm on the road, I visit as many zoos, aquariums. Hey, wait a minute. What's going on? Hey, what's going on there? Hello? Hello?
We interrupt your regularly scheduled program to bring you Rossafari Zoo News. News you can use from the world of zoos and conservation. Every week, we bring you breaking news and analysis from around the globe, featuring the animals you love and the people who care for them. And here's your anchorman, John Rossi.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to Rossafari Zoo News, your look at everything going on in the world of zoos, aquariums, conservation, and general animal weirdness. Y'all, I wanted to start with a quick programming note this week. For those paying attention to the interview episodes, I had said we were going to be spending about a month in Australia talking to different facilities there. And then after 2 weeks, we were suddenly in Greensboro, North Carolina, and Nepal, to be fair. But neither of those places are in Australia. Well, it turns out that the time zone issue, along with some other things, you know, things happen when you're trying to get interviews done, those things all contributed to lead to some complications with the interviews I was supposed to do for the second part of my Australia journey. So there are still two more people I'm supposed to talk to down under mite at some point here in the near future, but we'll see what happens. Things happen, but I did just want to let y'all know, just in case you were curious. Don't worry whether those interviews happen or not, and I hope they do. We've got a lot of great content coming down the pike for y'all. And that brings us to me talking about your favorite subject, me. I kid. But yeah, so the entire process of getting started at the Aquarium of Niagara as a volunteer had a hidden concern for me that I haven't talked about on here, or really with almost anyone about it. I know I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I hate seafood. Like, I hate it. When I was younger, the very smell of it was enough to make me gag and even risk throwing up. Okay, actually, we are all friends here. And we have our weekly poop story.
Poop story.
So I'm not going to lie to you all. It would actually make me throw up regularly. And I say that because my family loves seafood. So I got taken to a lot of seafood restaurants growing up. And occasionally I'd be fine, but often I wouldn't be. Honestly, it was usually pretty darn lucky if I was able to make it all the way to the bathroom before losing my lunch or dinner. There are plenty of diners who were eating at a Red Lobster or some such place in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, or Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, on dates that happened to coincide with the birthdays of my parents or my nanny and poppy or on Mother's Day or something like that, who got to witness, let's just say they got dinner and a show that day. And while this has become less of an issue over the years, and I'm now quite able to not lose it when I am near the smell of seafood, it's still very much not my favorite thing. So actually, when I first started meeting animals like pinnipeds for the podcast, I was genuinely curious to see how I would handle feeding them raw fish. And I was pleasantly surprised to discover that I didn't mind at all because I was so excited about the animal I was interacting with. But what about at an aquarium where I could be spending hours in a commissary with just seafood and no sea lions cheering me on? Well, it turns out that knowing that it is for animals that I love has already made it become a total non-issue for me. I don't mind it at all. Heck, I'd even go as far as to say I enjoy it. Knowing that penguins, seals, sea lions, and even a very special little sea turtle are going to get to eat their favorite foods and stay healthy and grow strong because of what I'm doing is pretty awesome, not gonna lie. And yes, I do realize that it's not like if I wasn't there, they wouldn't be getting fed. But I am there, and I'm the one making sure it happens in those moments, along with my incredible team, of course. And honestly, it's magical. Now, kind of amusingly, I still wouldn't be willing to wait tables or work in the kitchen of a Red Lobster because, well, humans suck, and I still hate the smell when it's cooked and when people are eating seafood. But for the animals, heck, I miss it when I'm not there already. So yeah, that's pretty cool, and I wanted to share that with y'all. And speaking of sharing, don't forget to share this podcast with lots of people, because mainly because of our great transitions like that, amazing segues. Make sure you hit subscribe so you don't miss anything. Make sure you follow along on the socials at Rossafari, on TikTok at Rossafari Pod, all those good things. And don't forget that you can contribute to Zoo News episodes by sending me stories to my email, rossafaripod@gmail.com, or, tagging me in them on the socials. If you do so, I'll say your name at the end of the episode, whether I use the story or not, which is a pretty good transaction, if you ask me. So, all right, enough of this preamble. Let's get to it. All right, we have some breaking news this week that came out right before I recorded, so I'm still looking into the ramifications of all of it, but it turns out that on Thursday, March 7th, the mayor's office of the city of Miami gave the Miami Seaquarium a notice of the termination of their lease with Miami-Dade County, with the letter calling for the Seaquarium to surrender the land back to the county on or before April 21st. Now, if you've seen this on social media or just are a headline reader, you may have gotten the impression that this is a done deal and that the Miami Seaquarium will cease to exist by that time. But this is not the case. It's actually a far more complex situation. So, as a quick reminder, Miami Seaquarium is the place where Lolita, or Toki, passed away recently. It's been the subject of numerous welfare complaints, has faced controversy not just from the expected groups, and has received multiple citations stating that tanks are in disrepair and that animals are not being properly taken care of. As a matter of fact, as I dug into this story further, I came to find out that back in December, the mayor's office let Miami Seaquarium know it planned to terminate the lease based on unpaid rent and other alleged violations of the terms of the lease, which does include welfare expectations as well as maintenance demands. The mayor's office then followed up in January with another letter letting the Seaquarium know they were not pleased after the U.S. Department of Agriculture reported that dolphins and other animals were not being cared for properly at the park. That letter was then followed up with this eviction notice. However, while the notice gives the park until April 21st to surrender the land, Seaquarium does have rights and will be able to fight the decision in court. So that date is nothing more than the start of the efforts to kick the park out, as litigation can drag on for weeks or months or even years. In speaking to the press about this issue, Eduardo Albor, the president of the Dolphin Company, which owns the Miami Seaquarium, said, and I'm quoting here, "I will just let my lawyers defend our rights. The mayor is lying." Sure. Okay. The mayor is lying. I mean, look, I get it. Politicians lie, and the Seaquarium has been under intense scrutiny since the death of Toki. But let's be clear here. Complaints have come in from former staff, from current staff speaking anonymously, from the Department of Agriculture, the Miami-Dade County Board of Commissioners, the Alliance of Marine Mammal Parks, and American Humane. Maybe more that I'm missing. But hey, maybe they were all lying too? Anyway, if and when the park loses its legal battles and is forced to vacate, The biggest question I have, and I think a lot of us have, is what will happen to the animals? It's not like marine mammals are easy to move or transport, and whistleblowers have stated that many of the animals that live at the park are not in the best shape. The truth is, I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows at this point what would happen to the animals. Since this is a legal action aimed strictly at the lease, I would assume the dolphin company still will own all of those animals and can choose to do with them what they will. Hopefully groups like the AZA and American Humane will step in and find solutions for these animals. Hopefully the dolphin company will allow them to. Until then, all we can do is wait and see what happens, but this is definitely going to be an interesting story to follow over the next weeks, months, and potentially even years. Stories like this drive me crazy because this will get so much more press than all of the amazing things being done at amazing facilities all around the country combined. And it's so hard sometimes to fight this battle and to try to talk to people about why zoos and aquariums do amazing things when this is the story that most people will hear. It's just heartbreaking, but enough of this for now. We're going to move on to our births and deaths. Though I have to tell you, this week really featured a lot of both of them. I probably could have done an entire episode of just births and deaths this week, but that wouldn't be very interesting. So I'm only going to do some here, and we'll save the rest for another episode. The Dallas Zoo has announced the birth of twin Emperor Tamarin babies, or Emperor Tamlets. This is the third set of twins born to Letty and Roger, and the little ones are doing well riding around on their parents' backs. The Adelaide Zoo has announced the birth of 9 fat-tailed Dunnarts. And I'm not body-shaming here. That is the name of the species. These little marsupials are adorable, and I highly recommend that you go to @zoossa for South Australia to look at pictures of these little fat-tailed Dunnarts. They're ridiculous. The Fort Worth Zoo has been doing amazing reptile breeding lately, and honestly, for a really long time. And they have recently announced the hatching of 6 veiled chameleons. The zoo mentioned in their post announcing the birth that the feet of the chameleons are a different color than their bodies because their feet change color based on their stress level or for camouflage purposes. Now, you may be thinking, yeah, John, but that doesn't explain the feet because all chameleons can change color all over. Well, it turns out that when they are very young, veiled chameleons are only able to change the color of their feet. The rest of their body develops that ability as they get closer to a year old. So, you know, the more you know and all that. Edmonton Valley Zoo has announced the birth of 4 North American River Otter pups, or North American River Otlets. The quadruplets were born on Valentine's Day and are not visible at this time as they are still hanging out in their nest box, but they are ridiculously adorable. The Toledo Zoo has announced a big birth. In fact, it's a new male African elephant. The ellet was conceived by a sophisticated artificial insemination process. The zoo is hosting a naming contest on their socials where you can vote for the name by making a donation through a link on their profile. So if you would like to contribute to the Toledo Zoo and help name an elephant, you can. And then last but not least in births this week, Zoo New England has announced the birth of a prehensile-tailed porcupine at Stone Zoo. Porcupets, yes, that's the real name for baby porcupines. In my suggested terminology, it would be a porlet. And yes, I admit that porcupet is better than that. But anyway, they are born with all of their quills, but they are soft and brown and the quills harden over time. This little one is extra adorable, so check out at Zoo New England for photos. And of course, that then moves us to our deaths. The Santa Fe Teaching Zoo has announced the passing of their two red-bellied hornbills, Clark and Ndizi. Apparently, a native animal was able to break into the secure habitat of the two birds and killed them both. I can't even imagine what it must be like to be a keeper and walk in to find something like that. The zoo is performing a necropsy to hopefully get a better idea of what happened and will be examining the habitat to make sure it is secured against anything like this happening again in the future. Sending love to the entire team at the zoo. The Akron Zoo has said goodbye to Gondar, the male speaks gazelle. When Gondar started to show signs of illness, the veterinary team discovered a mass on his lung, so the decision was made to humanely euthanize him. This is an especially challenging loss as Gondar has actually gotten over another medical issue in the last few years. He severely fractured his front leg in a way that required a very specialized surgery. That was actually very successful. Gazelles put a lot of weight on their front legs, and they have tiny little hooves, so the structural integrity of their leg is very important. The surgery worked, though, and even though he always had a limp, Gondar did well and brought a lot of joy to his keepers. His unique gait stood as a reminder to the team to enjoy the little things and not to take life for granted. And he will be greatly missed. Mystic Aquarium has announced the passing of Astro, the beloved stellar sea lion that lived at the aquarium. He had been suffering from multiple issues due to his advanced age, and they all kind of worsened together this week, so now he is gone. Astro had a larger-than-life personality and was a favorite amongst both team members and guests, and will be sorely missed. And last but not least in the deaths this week, Lehigh Valley Zoo has announced the passing of Emmy, a 16-year-old female ostrich. Emmy had lived at the zoo with a male ostrich, and they shared their exhibit with two Grant's zebras, which was awesome to see. She was a curious girl who loved shiny objects and a good bath, and the zoo just won't be the same without her. Sending all my love to the team at the Lehigh Valley Zoo. And, of course, that brings us to our other zoo news stories. And we're going to start off, get a little preachy here, but hey, that's okay. So whenever you talk to zookeepers or people trying to become zookeepers or get into the industry in any way, one of the biggest complaints is that it often takes unpaid internships to really get into the career. The idea is that if you go to college for 4 years to get a bachelor's of biology or some equivalent degree, and while doing so, or immediately after, or both, you spend a few months of your time working a job, either part-time or sometimes full-time, without getting paid for it, to get the basic experience necessary to get hired into a lot of zookeeping positions. This is a topic that is constantly discussed and has become even more of an issue in recent years as diversity and inclusion efforts have become more commonplace, with the argument being that people who come from disadvantaged communities are less likely to be able to afford to work for free and thus are excluded from the path into the industry. In recognition of this problem, and the problem of free labor in general, the AZA has announced that it will stop posting free internships on its online job board. They actually made the decision and implemented the change in February without telling anyone in advance, but the suddenness of the policy change led to a lot of complaints. So they have walked back the rule for now, with the implementation date changed to July 1st of this year. The AZA itself offers internships, but stopped offering ones without pay back in 2017. I think this new decision is a great step in the right direction for the AZA, but it also begets the question. In the official announcement from AZA President Dan Ash is the sentence, We are not mandating that our members stop unpaid internships, only that they not be advertised on the AZA jobs page. We look forward to continuing this dialogue and this journey with all of you. Well, my question is this. If the AZA is opposed to unpaid internships, why aren't they mandating the cessation of them? It doesn't have to be an immediate thing, but it can become a requirement for accreditation in the future, maybe even giving facilities a few years to incorporate it into their budgets. It is my sincere hope that this is the direction the AZA is going to take, because you can't admit this is a huge problem for people and then ignore it as part of what is supposed to be the gold standard of accreditation for zoos and aquariums. In the email announcing this policy, Dan Ash quoted Martin Luther King Jr. saying, "The time is always right to do what is right." And adding to that quote, saying, "I suspect he might have added, even when doing so is difficult, maybe especially then." Well, if the AZA is going to admit that unpaid internships are not right, then maybe they should read their own paragraph and decide that the time is right to do what is right, even when doing so is difficult, and end unpaid internships at AZA-accredited facilities across the board. I'm really grateful that they are taking this first step, and I don't mean to minimize it too much, but at the end of the day, if you admit there's a problem and all you're doing is not advertising it, I mean, what's going on here, guys? What's going on? If this is a problem, let's fix it. Let's do the right thing. It's actually kind of weird to me that they admit it's a problem, but that it's not a part of accreditation right now. So here's hoping they fix that problem in the future. All right, moving on. Just another quick reminder here about online scammers trying to get you to buy discounted tickets to zoos. They are fake, they won't work, and you'll be out money. Apparently, some scammers have started offering discounted memberships instead of tickets, which not only make them more money, but also gives them access to more personal information about you to use for other scams. So stay vigilant and keep reporting the scams when you see them. And hey, a special thanks to everyone who has reached out to tell me they saw these scams and reported them. It really makes me feel good to know that we're having an impact and that the Raw Safari community is out there reporting these things. The Chattanooga Zoo, or Chattazooga as I like to call it, has announced that three new species will be joining the zoo soon. They are opening a Cape of Africa section featuring Cape porcupines, warthogs, and servals. The new section of the zoo will be open this summer, so if you're around Chattanooga, make sure you check it out. The zoo has also opened up additional red panda encounters, which admittedly have nothing to do with the new area I just mentioned, but I wanted to let you all know because the encounters there are pretty darn great. You can find more info about the new area and the encounters on their website and their socials. The Toronto Zoo recently shared a story about one of the raccoons that calls the zoo home, and it's too good not to share. Marco the raccoon arrived at the Toronto Zoo roughly a year ago after being found as an illegal pet. Marco weighed over three times the weight of a typical male raccoon. Because of his weight issues, Marco was almost incapable of walking, and when he did walk, he would need to rest after every few steps, every single time. The wildlife health team at the zoo teamed up with the wildlife nutrition team to develop a weight loss program for a raccoon, targeting a 5% loss of body weight each week. Due to his mobility issues and the fact that he had been given such a terrible diet before when he was a pet, the newly prepared diet had to be spoon-fed to Marco for several months. Despite the fact that that was a pain in the butt, the diet was successful, and in just a few months, his mobility increased. As it did, so did his willingness to move and exercise more. As a matter of fact, he became so active, the keeper's staff was able to stop decreasing his caloric intake as he was burning more calories. In September, 6 months after arriving at the zoo, Marco was considered in good enough shape to leave the hospital where he was being taken care of, and he moved into the Canadian Domain section of the zoo, where he was integrated into a natural habitat with another raccoon companion, likely the first other raccoon Marco had ever met. I just love this story. Just so much. And we also have a fascinating story out of the UK this week. A 7-year-old macaque named Honshu recently escaped from the Highland Wildlife Park in Scotland and was not found for 5 days. Upon his discovery and return to the park, Honshu was found to be perfectly healthy, but when a primate is separated from its troop for a while, the dynamics of re-entry can be quite complex. Given these dynamics and the fact that Honshu was entering the age range where macaques often leave home to start their own families, the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland, which is such a great name, made the decision to move Honshu from Highland to Edinburgh Zoo to start a new life. Now, he isn't traveling alone, as 3 other males from his troop have moved with him to help with the transition. But I think this is an interesting story because it's such a unique look at how the people that take care of primates need to be very aware of troop dynamics and expectations to best care for their animals. The New England Aquarium Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life, which is also a really great name, was recently doing an aerial survey when they saw something incredible: a gray whale off the New England coast. Now, the gray whale went extinct in the Atlantic over 200 years ago, and obviously hasn't been seen in the area since. Experts believe that what probably happened is that someone bought the whale when it was a baby and raised it at home until it got too big and then, that's what happens with alligators and invasive snakes and stuff. My bad. What experts are actually saying is that climate change may be the culprit here, and that this story, as incredible as it is, may actually be negative, be a bad omen, let's say. The Northwest Passage that connects the Atlantic to the Pacific through the Arctic Ocean in Canada is usually blocked with thick winter ice, which prevents whales from traveling it and crossing into the Atlantic. However, the passage has been ice-free in recent years during the summer, allowing the whale to move through it freely. It's possible that others have or will make the trek as well. So, it's an interesting story, as it is both a species returning to its native habitat, which we love to see, but it's for reasons that are pretty concerning. I'll be curious to see what happens with this whale, and if others join it over time. It'd be kind of cool to have that population back, even if the reason why is scary. So I have to give props to Woodland Park Zoo. They did the whole be transparent early about a medical treatment thing that I love so much. Lily, the oldest hippo at the zoo at 45 years old, was recently found to need dental work and wound surgery, a process involving nearly 30 zoo staff and an external veterinary dentist. Given Lily's age and the fact that she's beloved at the zoo amongst both staff and guests, the zoo put out an announcement asking for well wishes for Lily in advance of the procedure, which is obviously something I really want to see more of in the zoo world. And they got a lot of well wishes. Then they posted a follow-up saying that the procedure had been a success. So congrats to Lily and the team, and thank you to the zoo for your transparency. I love to see it. The Maryland Zoo has announced that a new animal will be coming to the zoo early next year, with plans to build a new habitat starting soon. They have already started and are going to continue dropping hints on social media for the next 2 weeks before the official announcement, and I'm really excited to see the hints and the eventual announcement. Thanks to a secret informant, Yeah, I know. I said that to sound cool. Leave me alone. It's not that cool. Anyway, I actually happen to know what the species is, but I'm not saying a word, not giving it away until the zoo does. Suffice it to say, I think y'all are going to be really excited about this one. I know I am. And last but not least for Zoo News this week, speaking about building habitats, the giant panda area of Smithsonian's National Zoo is currently undergoing a $1.7 million facelift. While no announcement of giant pandas returning to the zoo has been made, this does seem like a positive development for those of us who wish to see the bears back at the zoo. I'll be crossing my fingers that as we enter the next age of panda diplomacy, the National Zoo will be included again. And that brings us to
Stereotypical Animal Podcast Theme Song. Here to bring you to conservation news.
So, this is one of those stories that I like to share, in part because it's good news, but also because I like equipping y'all when it's time to discuss the impact of conservation with naysayers. Sea otters were once hunted to near extinction, but conservation efforts were successful. They are still considered an endangered species, but the population has gone from close to zero to currently being estimated at around 3,000 in the wild, with strong plans in place to continue to grow the population. Now, that's awesome news in and of itself, but a new study has shown that the rebounded sea otter population has been chowing down on the burrowing crab population that had expanded during the time sea otters were largely missing from the environment. These crabs have been eroding the salt marshes in central California, getting rid of essential seagrasses, and causing the coastlines to disappear at an alarming rate. Coastal erosion is one of the biggest environmental concerns to communicate to people that don't care about conservation as its own thing, because it directly affects the affluent landowners with their beachfront properties. Now, with sea otters eating the crabs, the land erosion has stalled in central California, and the reemergence of seagrasses has led to other creatures returning to the area, helping to heal the ecosystem in an unexpectedly rapid way. And I think that's the part of conservation that I don't see communicated clearly enough, honestly. Nature, left to its own devices, has a pretty solid balance overall. The world will take care of itself. When humans screw things up, and oh boy do we, what often happens is we throw just one aspect of that balance off in ways that we can't even begin to comprehend. As people were hunting sea otters, did they even know burrowing crabs existed? If so, did they realize that sea otters were keeping them in check? And that there would be a time in the future when those crabs could take down coastlines and put properties at risk? My guess is no, they hunted to hunt. And when people stepped in to save the sea otters, they focused on saving the sea otters to, well, save the sea otters. They didn't know or promote the fact they would also bring balance to a population of crabs and, in the process, repopulate the salt marshes with other animals and also help to secure the coastline. Conservation is an incredible interconnected web, and the better we get at finding those connective threads and communicating them to people, the better we will do in convincing people that conservation efforts are important beyond just saving the species that we're talking to them about. And actually, our next story is a great example of that. It happens in Florida. Now, I've talked a lot about the fact that Florida is a politically shocking state in one regard. It's one of the most conservative MAGA states in the country. However, the same people who vote against reproductive rights and even move to ban books regularly sign off on environmental laws that would be seen as liberal by most of the people on, quote, their side. For instance, the State Senate of Florida just passed HB 321, banning the intentional release of balloons in Florida. No more animals will die because of weddings or funerals or whatever the balloon releases are happening for. Well, I mean, I'm sure people will still do it, but less animals will die. Yay! And keep in mind, this is a political body with 28 Republicans and 12 Democrats. And the bill was proposed initially in the House and passed there, where the split is 84 Republicans to 36 Democrats. And while I admit that it's a bit reductionist to just say Democrats are good for the environment and Republicans are bad for it, that has, by and large, been the case on a national scale. However, Florida shows what actually connecting the idea of conservation to the bigger picture and showing the positive benefits for humans can accomplish. I don't think it's a coincidence that this message has taken hold in Florida, the state with the second most amount of coastland after only Alaska. So these two stories kind of turned into a bit of a rant, which was not actually my plan when I started talking about cute little sea otters, but there it is. I think there are some great takeaways here, and I hope this helps y'all think about ways to communicate how saving individual species can make a huge impact on the world and on humans, even if a lot of us animal lovers don't tend to think about that when we try to save animals because, you know, we're thinking about saving animals. And it is important that we get more people on the conservation train here because there is just, like, constantly bad news out there, even with all the good stuff. I often try not to focus on too much doom and gloom in this section because I know what listening to a bunch of bad stuff can do to our brains, and I want y'all to listen and enjoy yourselves without it feeling like an aural doom-scrolling session. But we have to talk about some of the bad stuff, too, and that includes this fun statistic. The amount of plastic on Earth now outweighs all land and sea creatures that are currently alive. Yep, there is more plastic on this planet than all sea and land creatures combined, which is just a terrible statistic, unless you're made of plastic, I guess. Which, to be fair, most of us are at least partially that now, thanks to microplastics. So maybe this is actually good news? Maybe it means we will all live longer since plastics last practically forever? Okay, no. But seriously, this statistic is disheartening, but at least we keep making advances in moving away from plastics and also in how to dispose of them. So even though that's a crazy stat, it's not one we can't reverse with some time and effort. Just got to get everyone behind it. And last but not least in conservation news, 87 animals were recently seized at an airport in Bangkok after smugglers attempted to get the animals out of the country. Amongst the animals taken were snakes, parrots, monitor lizards, and a red panda, which was found in a basket. And look, y'all know I love red pandas, but they don't make good pets. And I know, you know that. I know that. We all know that. Heck, my son regularly tells kids that when they say they want one as we stand at a red panda exhibit. Doesn't make a lot of friends that way, but I'm very proud of him for doing some conservation messaging at 9 years old. But yeah, this stands as a stark reminder that the message hasn't gotten home to everyone yet. When I see Red Panda Network regularly post no panda pets as part of their messaging, it sometimes seems just so painfully obvious to me. But this is a great reminder of why we need to keep getting that message out there. And that brings us to
it's time for other news. It's time for other news. Hey, right now it's time. It's time for other news. Hey, it's a segue to the Parker other news.
A woman made news in Australia this week after being stung by a platypus. Yup, male platypuses create venom in glands which are connected to hollow spurs on their hind legs. And when Jenny Forward found a platypus stranded on the side of the road, she tried to help it out. And instead, she found out about the venomous spurs firsthand as she was struck with excruciating pain. She said that her head felt like it was going to explode and that the pain was worse than childbirth. Having never given birth and never been stung by a platypus, I really don't have a horse in this race. But I knew that they were venomous, but I never realized how painful getting spurred by a platypus could be. And last but not least in other news this week, the world-famous Bellagio fountains in Las Vegas had to shut down briefly this week because of a bird. A yellow-bellied loon, a bird not usually found as far inland as Las Vegas, landed in the fountains, and the Nevada Department of Wildlife was informed. They asked the casino to shut down the famous tourist attraction until they were able to safely rescue the bird and move it to a safer, more bird-friendly location. With this completed, the fountains were able to turn back on and start dancing for the crowds on the Vegas Strip again.
Oh, animal, oh, animal, animal holidays, animal, oh, animal, animal holidays, hey!
All right, it is still March, which is the month of my birthday, which is all that matters in March. Well, okay, no, it's not. But again, my birthday is March 31st. Friendly reminder to everyone who wants to celebrate, which is me. But still, it's also Dolphin Awareness Month, so that's cool too. And then for the week, we have Learn About Butterflies Day, which is March 14th, and Save a Spider Day, which is March 14th. And that's it. Two animal holidays on one date. Nothing else this whole week. Cool. Cool, cool, cool. I know this is a thing that just isn't going to change, but it kind of drives me crazy how we distribute these days. But I guess there isn't a National Animal Holiday Committee or whatever. But there should be. Maybe one of you could get me that for my birthday, which is March 31st. Anyway. There you have it, folks. Rossafari Zoo News is done for another week. I would like to say thank you to my Red Panda level patrons, Dr. Laura Shank, Dr. Stephen Williamson, Barbara Bennett, and Jenny Owens. I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who contributed stories this week, including Anya Keene, Colleen Lenahan, Kim Cooley Croninger, Carrie Kirkpatrick, Kevin Williams, Emily Rockbuck, Dr. Laura Shank, who was not so much the angel of death this week or the angel of life, but just, you know, shared some stories with me. All I can say is that whatever she shares, she's an angel. Michael Sebastian, Melissa Reed, Jacob Zinn, Elizabeth Charles, yes, Ann Yoshioka, Ren Howell, who, you know, is Australian and is the one who sent me the whole more painful than a pregnancy thing and who recently had a baby. So I'm sure she was feeling that one and maybe even questioning the veracity of it. I don't know. Ken Tryon, Jay Meredith, Ali Malensky. Oh, but no, Kay Malensky. I'm telling you, man, this married life, this marital bliss, oh, it's ruining it. So you only get half the song this week. The Malen. Yeah, that's right. I made a farting noise. What you going to do about it, Kay, huh? Anyway, and Kristen Dickey, thank you all so much for contributing. And thank you all for listening and being here. Love this community. Love you all. Excited to be back on Tuesday with another new episode. And last but not least, of course, I need to remind you that the words Newsy Credits backwards are Steiderk Yeswen. The Rossafari Podcast is produced, hosted, and engineered by John Rossi. Editing and fact-checking by John and Dr. Zoe Rossi. Our theme song is Sevens by Nathan Burke, performed by Nathan and John. Interrupting John theme and additional voices by Taylor Isaac Gray. You can reach John directly on Instagram and Facebook at Rossafari or by email at rossafaripod@gmail.com. Rossafari is part of the Daydreamer Media Network. Now, stop listening to me and go visit a zoo. apparently some scammers not only... Nope, I read the wrong line. Ha ha!